What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said that Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated to protect U.S. assets in Iraq, its people in Syria, and in fact, Americans all across the world. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how the U.S. foreign policy has stooped to such lows as to subscribe to assassinations, while revealing how U.S. presence in the West Asia region has been met by defeat one after another. First, our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Emeritus Professor at Westchester University, Lawrence Davidson, joins us from Westchester, PA. Also joining us, editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, who joins us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. So first, let me start with you, if I may, Kevin Barrett. We're looking at what former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said, the reason why the U.S. assassinated with the direction of Donald Trump by his orders, the former U.S. president of Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, that he said that they did that because they wanted to safeguard U.S. assets in Iraq, its people in Syria, and, in fact, Americans all across the world. What do you think about what he has said?
Well, it's just obviously complete nonsense. Unlike the Americans, General Soleimani and his forces were not targeting people at random. They were not targeting people because they were Americans. And indeed, they weren't even targeting Americans. They had a policy of not going after Americans. And in fact, the U.S. had lured General Soleimani to Iraq en route to supposed peace talks that it pretended to be setting up with Saudi Arabia for some kind of a regional peace agreement or kind of a truce. And so he was on a peace mission, and it was a complete deception. And so the truth, of course, is, as usual, the exact opposite of what you hear from people like Mike Pompeo. That is that General Soleimani had a lot of success at moving the region in a direction that will ultimately result in more peace. And he did that by waging these campaigns of resistance that were overall highly moral and ethical in terms of the conduct of the following rules of war. And so this notion that he was some kind of terrorist who was out to randomly kill Americans, everybody knows that's untrue. And in fact, everybody also knows that Pompeo is an Israeli-controlled neocon who was doing the work of the Zionist lobby, which has so distorted U.S. Middle East policy, and indeed most of the terrorism in the region has come out of either the Zionists directly or indirectly through their American proxy that they hijacked through buying influence and dominating the U.S. and owning people like Mike Pompeo. So Pompeo is not only a liar, but he's also a traitor. He betrayed the United States of America in order to work for the most extreme Likud wing of the Zionist entity. Okay. And the war killing General Soleimani was done on behalf of the Israelis, as Trump has practically admitted ever since then.
What we're trying to do over here, Lawrence Davidson, is not to rehash news that has been analyzed before, but to look at it as a window as to how the U.S. foreign policy has been executed, which is very much under question, especially when you have what Mike Pompeo said about the reasons for the assassination of General Soleimani, when you had American intelligence officials to have said that there was no such evidence as to the involvement of General Soleimani's plan for an attack on U.S. forces, because they were Pompeo had said that he was going to attack or he was going to be responsible for the death of 500 or attack of 500 U.S. personnel. Is that the type of thinking that the foreign policy is under, coming from somebody who, in his case, has said that I was the CIA director, we lied, we cheated, and we stole?
Well, that's pretty accurate. I mean, they do lie, and they do cheat. I don't know about stealing, but I think that the problem is that there's no coordinated overall plan in terms of foreign policy. It's very, very sporadic and reactionary rather than proactive. And so you get these sort of either they're half kind of half baked efforts where you don't follow through, which is like Syria. I mean, the Russians follow through. We don't follow through. And you get
why do you think the U.S. doesn't follow through? Why doesn't the U.S. follow through?
Yeah, well, I think that it's sporadic, that they don't, that it, at the political level, they don't really have a plan. So they react in terms of how they feel the policy will spit back in terms of the U.S. reaction, popular reaction, and what have you. And so really, it's the policymakers' judgment of domestic reaction that really controls how ultimately they'll react in these foreign policy issues. So, and they also misjudge. They misjudge that they, because they don't they either don't know what's going on in these regions, or they don't take the intelligence reports accurately. They don't react accurately to those reports, and so they'll just you know, make up things. And that's what happened in Iraq with Bush, where he just you know, why are we going into Iraq? Mm-hmm. Well, Saddam had a plot to kill my father. That's U.S. foreign policy. Okay. I mean, you know, it's just silly, stupid things.
Sure. And well, you mentioned Iraq, and I have to come to you, Kevin Baird, with this. Iraq's been talked about. What we are seeing as an output or a consequence of U.S. foreign policy in that country is how the Iraqi parliament voted to ask the U.S. to end its hosting of its troops in Iraq. Basically, they went with a motion to oust all foreign soldiers, including even those from Germany. When you have that type of consequence, that clearly just points to a failed U.S. foreign policy in Iraq. How did the U.S. end up like that in Iraq?
Yes, they've totally failed. They've also, the Iraqis have voted against any kind of recognition, to criminalize recognition of Israel. That's, of course, not what PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, wanted when they set these events in motion. Now, I do disagree with the other guest in that I think that there are people who have a plan, but it's not one plan, and it's not based on the U.S. national interest for the most part. I think that the plan was that we had this group around Netanyahu in the mid to late 90s that wanted to totally redraw the boundaries of the Middle East and on behalf of Israel, to change the realities on the ground. And they put out a clean break document. And then a few years later, in September of 2000, they put out Rebuilding America's Defenses. which was a thinly disguised claim that this was about helping U.S. Goals, when in fact what it was really about was redrawing the map of the Middle East for Israel. So they blew up the Twin Towers, did a false flag on 9/11, and the purpose of that was to not only unleash these specific wars, but also to change history in favor of Israel and against Islam and Muslims for a century or more. That was what that was all about. So they had a very clear plan, these mm-hmm. neoconservative Zionists who hijacked foreign policy on behalf of Likudnik forces in Israel. But that plan, they didn't completely own U.S. foreign policy, and Professor Davidson is right that there are other forces and all sorts of forces of chaos in foreign policy. The realists pushed back against this and prevented them from going all the way. And sure. So ultimately, this war, which was based on false pretenses, whose real purpose was to destroy the region on behalf of Israel, not to create anything lasting, not to achieve any positive goals, it partially succeeded. It did create tremendous damage in the region. It did create a wave of global Islamophobia that right. Israel will benefit from for decades, if not a century. It's spreading as far as India and so on. And so it did bear some fruit. However, for the United States, it blew up in the face of Uncle Sam, because this really was never an American policy to begin with. It's true, the American side doesn't have a plan. Unfortunately, the Likudnik Zionist side does have plans.
One of the ones that the U.S. has admitted to, Lawrence Davidson, is its policy towards Iran. I mean, the most recent one coming from the U.S. Special Envoy for Vienna talks, the Secretary of State, not to mention the President himself, Biden, who have said that the maximum pressure policy, and they attribute that to Trump, has failed on Iran, even though it's ironic that they're pursuing that policy now. That's another thing about the U.S., pursuing failed policies. You have a policy that's failed, and then you have the current administration following that maximum pressure policy still. Why is that?
Well, Kevin actually touched on this. Policy is often a reaction to powerful special interests. Okay, I mean, you can see it domestically with the gun lobby, and you can see it in terms of foreign policy specifically towards the Middle East, given the influence of the Zionists. And so Israel really does not want this Iran nuclear weapons deal to go through. They want it to just flounder. And so
it's a nuclear deal. It's not a it's not a nuclear weapons deal. I'm sorry. I had to just correct that. Sorry about that. No, that's okay.
Okay. So they wanted to flounder. And since, Biden has declared himself a Zionist, so who's influencing this sort of, jackass policy? It's you put in charge people who are most influenced by Zionists or Zionist elements within the Democratic Party or what have you, and you get this kind of effort to essentially make the policy flounder, make it fail, and so you know that you're pursuing a failed policy, and that's why you're doing it, because you want it to fail. It's a reaction to special interests. I don't particularly agree that there's about grand policies to redraw the Middle East. I think maybe that was in the mind of Bush Jr., but he was nuts anyway. I mean, he's crazy, and he's a criminal. He's a war criminal as a consequence. I think it's some of it is kind of sporadic, and it depends upon who's pushing the political buttons most effectively.
Well, it sounds like maybe the Pentagon is, because when you take a look at what has happened in Yemen, Kevin Barrett, mm-hmm. I mean, that was clearly something that was driven by arms sales. I mean, the former U.S. President Donald Trump didn't make any bones about that in his ostentatious display that he had at the White House when you had the Crown Prince with him. That's a failed policy, and we could see, obviously, what Saudi Arabia had to do, which is concede to talks. Was that policy just driven by arms manufacturers and arms sales?
Yeah, I think that was a lot of it. I think Lawrence is right about the special interests dominating U.S. policy and pushing it first one direction and then that, taking it on these crazy rides like the neocons did with the 9/11 wars. And in this case, yeah, the arms makers are getting rich selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. And Biden revealed himself as a complete hypocrite after pretending that he was the opposite of Trump on this and criticizing Trump. Well, they're all selling out to the Saudis. Obama did. Obama allowed the war in Yemen, if not actually encouraged it. And Trump just went along with that in a more ostentatious way. And now the same thing is happening under Biden, even after he spoke out so vociferously against it when he was campaigning and saying he would never do these things that Trump had done. And he would be whipping the Saudis into line and punishing them for killing Khashoggi and so on and so forth. And none of that came true. So he's a liar and a hypocrite, but they all are. And yeah, it's the arms manufacturers are a big part of it. And then there's also the Zionists are actually in favor of the U.S. support for the war on Yemen because the Zionists don't like the axis of resistance, which Yemen is a part of. So that lobby is also pushing it. And I think the folks who the few people in government that actually care about the interests of the U.S. empire, which I frankly don't care about that much, but they do. And that's their job. So that's what they should be caring about. Those people probably also think that, well, for the near future at least, trying to keep the axis of resistance under control and keep propping up these, you know, friends of Israel in the region as long as we can before the whole thing collapses is really about all we can do. So it's a very chaotic policy. It's driven in contradictory directions and often self-destructive directions by these lobbies
right.
and special interests. And there's really no principled vision, and I think Lawrence was right about that, in terms of thinking out how to have a win-win strategy where the U.S. does okay and other people do as well.
Okay.
That hasn't existed since the days of Kennedy and Eisenhower, if then.
Well, one of the things that's very striking here is the way that the Syria policy of the U.S. has unfolded, Lawrence Davidson, because when you look at the decade of war that happened there and all types of U.S. allies, including the U.S. itself, indirectly or covertly being involved in it, it not only did not result in the defeat of Syria and the ouster of democratically elected Assad, but rather you have some of the allies who are now receiving Assad with open arms, like the UAE. So you can see how that policy, just from that one particular angle, has also failed. Again, we're trying to break down the U.S. foreign policy here, and in West Asia, in this particular case, my question to you is on Syria. How do you think that unraveled for the U.S.?
Well, I think the initial impulse was essentially to overthrow Assad, okay? And that came also from the Israeli lobby, I think was a shaker and mover in that one. So the problem was that if you were going to overthrow Assad, you had to then surreptitiously anyway, support some really very unsavory terrorist kinds of folks, okay? And so there was a lot of uncertainty about how just to go about this. And that uncertainty, I think, led to a half-assed effort. And pretty soon, the U.S. couldn't compete with the locals. In other words, they didn't have the force and they didn't have the will to compete with Iran or Turkey or even the Russians in this area. And so they lost out. But I think originally they were trying to overthrow Assad, and of course that didn't happen. I think that the Americans in Washington, in other words, the administration, is very, very hungry for a win.
Where?
Okay? And that's why they're throwing everything they can into Ukraine.
Uh-huh. Okay, so another obsession. There we're talking about how they want to defeat Putin. All right, so let's look at Saudi Arabia, Kevin Barrett. Saudi Arabia obviously was one of the strongest allies that the U.S. could count on for the West Asia or the Middle East region, but we are looking how that relationship has been strained, especially through Biden. calling it a pariah state, and at this point not even talking to the crown prince. And it seems like he's going to be making a visit to the region, putting aside all of that and the human rights that Saudi Arabia is obviously violating for oil, because obviously there's a need for it. But is Saudi Arabia going to receive the U.S. presidents, and is that another U.S. foreign policy failure?
It is. It's a failure because it's obvious that it's the American side that's afraid of the Saudi side, which is kind of bizarre because since World War II, it's the U.S. that's been propping up this regime in Riyadh, arming them. They can't even use a lot of their weapons or fly their own planes, so the Americans send over their pilots and advisors and technicians and stuff. So it's really been kind of a U.S. Proxy state where the Americans get a deal. They have the Saudis export the oil only in dollars, and the Americans get the right to sell all the military equipment, make a lot of money. And the Americans have been the dominant party for a long time. And last time the Saudis got uppity was actually right before 9/11 in August. The king said that Saudi Arabia was going to have to go its own way and leave the U.S. empire because of the U.S. support for Israel. And then suddenly 9/11 happened, and a bunch of high-level Saudis who had supported that policy suddenly died. And then the next thing you know, Saudi Arabia has been reeled in. So the U.S. seemed like it was still in charge. But now they're not anymore. Now the clown prince can, you know, we all see him as a clown prince, but he's got the upper hand over the Americans somehow. He can tell them, he can refuse to take their phone calls. They call him begging him to pump more oil, and he doesn't even take the phone call. And so then Biden abjectly drops all of his demands for any kind of improvement on human rights and just goes there with his begging bowl to the king, to the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. Okay. So somehow, what's happened here? Apparently, the U.S. has lost so much prestige and so much soft power and perhaps hard power as well, losing the war in Syria, allowing the Russians to win in Georgia even before that. And now the Russians are on course to defeat NATO and win in Ukraine as well. And so the U.S. is a fading power. And Biden's abject surrender to the Saudis is a sign of that.
Okay. Talk about money, since I've heard that now in the statements. Lawrence Davidson, it was very shocking, in a sense, for many when the Afghanistan war and U.S. occupation there was ongoing, that the Pentagon comes out and says, we don't even know how much money we have spent. Because based on the accounting that took place, they couldn't account for billions of dollars, and I'm talking hundreds of billions of dollars, that was cited in a report. We can go on about that, but I'm curious as to whether these ventures, which all cost money, is about money.
Well, yes, I think that it's a lot of it is about money, and the nature of these ventures essentially creates a sphere or a environment for corruption. I mean, when you are distributing, you know, either in actual dollars or in materiel, millions and millions and millions of dollars per week, some of that is going to generate corruption, and corruption then becomes its own engine. So essentially, if you're not paying attention, or on purpose or otherwise, or if you don't care how the money is spent, or how the money ultimately is distributed, then, in fact, it's an invitation for not being able to account for billions of bucks.
Okay. We got less than 30 seconds here left. Kevin Barrett, former U.S. President Donald Trump, we have spent $7 trillion with a T in the Middle East, as he called it. You know what we have for it? Nothing. Does the U.S. have nothing to show for it in the Middle East or West Asia, as we call it?
Pretty much, yeah. Once again, Trump may mislie, and he's certainly not a reliable source. He's not very knowledgeable, but he speaks a lot of truth that nobody else is willing to speak that directly. He's absolutely right. Yeah, we spent $7 trillion and actually made our position worse. If the U.S. had just gotten out and stopped spending money on the region completely, rather than doing all these crazy things since the 9/11 false flag, we could have saved $7 trillion,
okay,
and we would actually have a better position in the region right now for not being there.
Thank you, Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today, and thank you, Lawrence Davidson, emeritus professor at Westchester University. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tawai and the team, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
والذين لا يشهدون الزور وإذا مروا باللغو مروا كراما
And they are those who do not testify to falsehood, and when they pass near ill speech, they pass by with dignity.
Brothers and sisters, we have reached the 72nd verse of Surah Al-Furqan. والذين لا يشهدون الزور وإذا مروا باللغو مروا كراما And those who witness no falsehood, and when they pass by what is vain, they pass by nobly. Following the previous holy verses, in which some of the attributes of the servant of the beneficent are mentioned, this verse explains the ninth outstanding attribute of theirs. The discussion over Ibadur Rahman started in about 63rd verse, where it says, الَّذِينَ يَمْشُونَ عَلَى الْأَرْضِ هَوْنَا The Holy Qur'an started mentioning some of the attributes of the true believers. It said that they are the ones who walk on the earth humbly. They are the ones that, when the ignorant address them, they answer peace. They are the ones who spent the night prostrating themselves before their Lord. They call out to their Lord and ask Him to avert them from the torment of hell. They are the ones that when they spend, they are neither extravagant nor niggardly, and they are stationed between these two. They do not call with Allah any other God. They do not slay the soul which Allah has forbidden, and they don't commit fornication. And now, this verse talks about the ninth attribute of theirs. وَالَّذِينَ لَا يَشْهَدُونَ الزُّورَ وَإِذَا مَرُّوا بِاللَّغْوِ مَرُّوا كِرَامًا. And those who witness no falsehood. About this part, great commentators have cited two various commentaries. Some say that the witness of zur means false testifying, because the word zur means the deviation and inclination. And since lying and falsehood and oppression are some deviated affairs, that is why they are called zur. This phrase, shahadatu zur, is also mentioned in the book of shahadat of our jurisprudence. It is what is prohibited in various narrations, though in those narrations, this verse has not been taken as an evidence. Anyway, another commentary is that the purpose of shahadatu zur, وَالَّذِينَ لَا يَشْهَدُونَ الزُّورِ, is attending and participation, which means that the special servants of Allah do not attend false gathering and parties. In some narrations of the infallibles, this word has been interpreted as parties of singing in which deviated singers are singing, as well as playing musical instruments. Of course, as we have always mentioned, the purpose of these narrations is not to limit the extensive concept of the Quranic word zur, but of course they are the clear extensions of this word. This word can also include all gatherings and parties in which wine is drunk, lie is told, and backbiting happens, and such like. So anywhere and any place where there is the sin being committed, that can be called a place of zur. Another possibility is that both commentaries are truly applying to the meaning of this verse. So, the special servants of Allah, or the special servants of the Beneficent, Ibadur Rahman, neither bear false witness nor attend sinful and vain parties, because attending such parties is both confirming sin and preparation to defilement of soul and heart.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, dear listeners, the beginning part of the verse was discussed. وَالَّذِينَ لَا يَشْهَدُونَ الزُّورِ, the ninth attribute, those who witness no falsehood. And the verse continues, وَإِذَا مَرُّوا بِاللَّغْوِ مَرُّوا كِرَامًا. And those that when they pass by what is vain, they pass by nobly. This means they have positive aim in life. They neither attend false and vain parties, nor do they get defiled with vanity and falseness. Regarding to the matter that the Quranic word لغو includes any job that has no rational aim, it is clear that they have always a rational and useful and good and somehow practical aim in their lives. They dislike those who are after vain and futile matters. In fact, they face such vain affairs in their lives, but they try to avoid them in a way that their negligence shows that they are inwardly discontented with such deeds. This is the exact meaning of marru kirama, passing by nobly. They are so magnanimous that such defiled environments never affect them. And of course, this happens when there is no better way to prohibit evil deeds and to struggle with corruption. Otherwise, they certainly stand against them. They do their duties to the end, and they never try to get away from their responsibilities. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, and that's when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
The shadows of Allah must be he whose movement is like Allah's and has nothing of himself. The Prophet of Islam was a shadow of Allah, because in Surah Al-Anfal in the Quran we read, "And you did not smite when you smote the enemy, and it was Allah who smote." Or elsewhere in Surah Al-Fat we read, "Swearing allegiance to Prophet is, O Prophet of Allah, is sufficient for you and for such the believers that follow you." What an honorable address for the pious believers. What an address of accountability for the pious believers.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio.
I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Quran. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that, "May you never confuse the sacred Quran and the salvation-giving faith of Islam with the false and deviant schools that are mere products of the human minds." Now, in this part of his speech, Imam Khomeini is clearly talking about what human beings are making up, what human minds can make, and what is the value of the products that are made by human minds. We are imperfect as a human being. We are trying to reach to the perfection. We are trying to get the development. Therefore, we sit, we plan, and we reached to the technology, maybe we reached to a specific advancement. But all these things were based on experiments that the human beings have done. And through experiences or through experiments, we have reached to a level of technology, to the level of an advancement. But while we were processing those things, obviously, we were in the process. On the other hand, no one can say that the advancement that we have today, the technology that we have today, is the ultimate technology. It's the last version of advancement. Why? Because in future, the generations who are coming in future, they will also say the same thing what we say about our previous generations, that they are backward. And the future generations will advance more in a better way as we are in today. They will advance in technology in a better way. The technology will be in another way. Therefore, no one can say that they are at the perfect state. Whereas Quran, which is the book of Allah or the God Almighty who has created us, who is perfect, who is all-powerful, who is all-living, who is all-knowledgeable, who is all-knowing, He has sent this Quran, and this Quran will remain till Qiyamah. Therefore, Imam Khomeini is saying, do not confuse the sacred Quran with the false and deviate schools and the interpretations that are given by the human minds. Why? Because the Quran is the wording of Allah, whereas these deviant schools and the false things that you see, these are made of human. Therefore, it is necessary to save ourselves from such things, inshallah, and following the Quran in its true way.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the limelight.
The Pentagon's ever-growing budget is quite simply a theft from American people, enriching some of the wealthiest corporations in this country, said one critic, adding, "It's disgraceful." Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stansil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "Revolting: Senate panel adds another $45 billion to Biden's military budget. Here's more. Progressives responded with disgust after the Senate Armed Services Committee voted to tack an additional $45 billion on top of President Joe Biden's already massive military spending request, bringing the total proposed budget for the coming fiscal year to a staggering $857.6 billion. The Biden administration's March request for $813 billion in military spending for fiscal year 2023 represented a $31 billion increase over the current level of $782 billion, which is already unprecedented. During its closed-door markup of the National Defense Authorization Act, the Senate Armed Services Committee approved a bill with a top-line budget of $847 billion, $817 billion of which is earmarked for the Pentagon. Roughly $10 billion of national military spending falls outside the Senate panel's jurisdiction. The House is expected to make its own push to further boost military spending for the next fiscal year. William Harting, a senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, called the Senate panel's decision misguided. The administration's proposal is already higher than spending at the peaks of the Korean and Vietnam Wars and over $100 billion more than at the height of the Cold War, Harting said in a statement, adding, "Throwing more money at the Pentagon will not make us safer. It will just divert funds from addressing other urgent challenges like pandemics and climate change that put millions of Americans at risk." Monica Montgomery, a research analyst at the Council for a Livable World, pointed out that the Senate committee's proposed $45 billion increase in military spending is equivalent to Biden's entire budget request for climate programs, demonstrating how Congress will value militarism and defense contractors over a livable future. If Congress truly wants to keep people safe, they must start by rejecting this increase and investing taxpayer dollars in human well-being instead, Tory Bateman, policy advocacy coordinator at the American Friends Services Committee, said in a statement. Earlier this week, Representatives Barbara Lee and Mark Pocan, co-chairs of the Defense Spending Reduction Caucus, introduced the People Over Pentagon Act of 2022, which proposes cutting Pentagon spending for the next fiscal year by $100 billion and reallocating those funds toward threats facing the U.S. that are not military in nature, such as the COVID-19 pandemic, the climate emergency, and worsening inequality. Although a majority of U.S. voters are opposed to military spending in excess of $800 billion, earlier efforts to slash the Pentagon's budget have failed to gain enough support to pass the House or Senate, thanks in part to lawmakers who receive significant amounts of campaign cash from the weapons industry, which benefits from constantly ballooning expenditures. Roughly 55% of all Pentagon spending went to private sector military contractors from fiscal year 2002 to fiscal year 2021, according to Stephen Semler of the Security Policy Reform Institute. If this privatization of funds rate over the last 20 years holds, Selmer wrote in December, arms dealers will gobble up an estimated $407 billion in public money in fiscal year 2022. In the words of Win Without War President Stephen Miles, the Pentagon's ever-growing budget is quite simply a theft from American people, enriching some of the wealthiest corporations in this country. Julia Gale-Hill, an analyst at the Project on Government Oversight Center for Defense Information, concurred. Increasing the Pentagon budget beyond President Biden's request isn't just irresponsible. It's a slap in the face to American taxpayers, said Gale-Hill, adding, year after year, the Department of Defense demonstrates its lack of fiscal discipline, failing financial audits, and sinking money into weapon programs that do little more than enrich defense contractors. This $45 billion increase isn't about national security or the American people, she added. It's about funneling money into the military-industrial complex. Senator Jack Reed, chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, told reporters recently that inflation was the first consideration in increasing the top line. He also cited the need to support some countries, replenish weapons sent to aid the countries, and fund military priorities not included in Biden's Pentagon request, Politico reported. The committee's ranking Republican, Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, hailed the proposed spending like as everything he hoped for. Experts, meanwhile, have documented how military spending has never moved in tandem with inflation. They have also warned that the nearly $60 billion worth of weaponry that Ukraine has already received from the U.S. is more likely to intensify the war than to advance peace, with arms manufacturers among the only beneficiaries of such prolonged suffering. The Senate Armed Services Committee's move to increase U.S. military spending comes despite the Biden administration's withdrawal from Afghanistan following 20 years of failed war. Robert Weisman, president of Public Citizen, a progressive advocacy group that is pushing the U.S. to ramp up vaccine manufacturing and inoculate the world against COVID-19 with an investment of just $25 billion, or roughly 3% of the nation's annual military budget, said that the Senate Armed Services Committee's choice to defy both the president and public opinion and flood the Pentagon with more money is outrageous. Weisman said, time and again, Congress funnels billions in additional funds to costly weapons programs, war, and defense contractors, while claiming that human needs would cost too much. Most Americans oppose efforts to rocket launch military spending towards $1 trillion per year. Lawmakers should reject this and champion human-centered spending instead.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and here is Batool. Welcome to the program for a better life. In our previous session, we posed this question as to what is a better life. Then we came to the conclusion that a better life is when a person is happy. This happiness is not the material happiness. but it is the happiness of the soul. So how can I reach this happiness? It is when I become a better person. Therefore, to have a better life, I need to be a better person first. In the last session, we were talking about the steps to become a better person. And the first step was yaqda, which means to awaken. Sometimes a short sentence from a pious one can awaken us and change our lives. In the previous session, we were talking about what Abu Basir had narrated about his neighbor who was indulged in sinning. When Abu Basir talked about his neighbor to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, Imam said, "Tell him, if he stops sinning, I will guarantee the paradise to him." Wonderful lines, brothers and sisters. Abu Basir, he continues saying, "When I returned back to Kufa after completing Hajj, people came to see me, including my next door neighbor. After exchanging greetings and inquiring about my trip, when he wanted to leave, I asked him to wait. When other people left my house, I said to him that I mentioned your problem to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and he replied that upon your return to Kufa, that man will come to see you. Tell him that Ja'far ibn Muhammad said, 'Quit sinning and I will guarantee paradise.'" Now this short message of Imam touched this neighbor's heart. He started crying, and then he asked Abu Basir, "Do you swear by God that Imam said these words for me?" Abu Basir replied, "I swear by God." And then he assured him that these are the exact words of Imam for him. He replied, the neighbor then he replied, he said, "These words are enough for me." He said these words and he left Abu Basir's house. Then Abu Basir continues, he says, "For several days I did not hear from him. One day he sent a message asking me to visit him. So I went to his house. He opened the door, but was hiding behind the door. Then he said, 'O Abu Basir, everything which I collected through haram, I have returned it to its owner. Right now, I possess absolutely nothing, not even a pair of clothing to cover myself. And that is why I'm standing behind the door. I quit all sins and have truly applied Imam's message in my life.'" Abu Basir continues, he said, "I was indeed happy to learn about his repentance and changed condition and wondered about the impact of Imam's short message upon him. I returned back to my house and arranged for some clothing and some food and brought it for him. After a while, he again called me, and when I went to see him, I found him sick."
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
He remained in this condition for quite some time, and during this period, I frequently visited him to take care of his needs. But unfortunately, his condition continued to deteriorate day by day, till one day I found him struggling between life and death. While I was sitting on his side and he was taking his last breaths, he suddenly opened his eyes and said, 'O Abu Basir, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has fulfilled his promise. he said these words and closed his eyes forever. Then Abu Basir continues, after some time, I had the opportunity for going to Hijaz for Hajj and also to